Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. We're getting a little bit of a late start, but that's all right. We'll punch through this. Today is June 16th, 2015. We're going to open up a work session first on Senate Bill 5518 related to legislative agencies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you probably remember from the public hearings, Senate Bill 5518 actually is the budget for six agencies, all six legislative branch agencies, if you will, which includes legislative administration, the legislative assembly, legislative fiscal office, legislative council, legislative revenue office, and the Commission on Indian Affairs. The LFO recommendation contains the following adjustments. There are reductions across the board for anticipated reversions. The legislative branch actually gets to keep its general fund reversions at the end of the biennium. So those, we subtract those out, the anticipated reversions, and then they will be added back in through an administrative process once the actual reversion numbers are known in the following biennium. So we reduce it now. The money will be added back in the following biennium. There's a technical adjustment to remove some one-time funding in the legislative revenue office. That's a $200,000 reduction. It was just an inadvertently left in. There was a one-time project that they were supposed to do, and it accidentally got left in their budget, so we took it out. There's an elimination of the assembly post-session account, $24,000, $24,611. Implementation of the policy office for the branch. That was built into the base budget, about $1 million. It's anticipated that the actual implementation of that will not occur until after the 2016 session, so that saves about $200,000 general fund. There are some debt service adjustments between a couple of projects, actually. The design phase of the capital renovation project came in under what was anticipated. It was supposed to originally be about $34.5 million. They only issued about $29.1 million worth of bonds, so there's some debt service savings related to that. And then there were some leftover bond proceeds from two different projects, one being the Wings project, another one being a bill drafting project. Those projects are all done. All the expenditures have been, there was some leftover bond proceeds, so they'll be used those to pay debt service on a one-time basis. There was a reduction to the presiding officer change reserve account, about $2,000 of general fund. There's a $75 increase to each of the caucus offices for transition services. That's a total of $30,000 general fund. There's additional funding for increased field hearings, $5,000 of general fund. And there's a net zero change for the Secretary of the Senate. Their budget was, with the change in the Secretary of the Senate, their personal services were a little askew. So they had too much money in services and supplies and a little too little in personal services, a net change of $103,535 nets to zero. It's just a shift between services and supplies and personal services. There's an additional page/doorkeeper position for the chief clerk, $29,255, one position, 0.25 FTE. There's a fund shift for the member lounge staff from other funds to general funds of $60,038. Increase of $2,000 for member session budgets. That's $180,000 general fund total. There are four projects in the legislative administration, one of them being a disaster recovery cold site, and you heard about all these during the public hearing. $105,890 for that. And there's repairs to the ceiling, the basement, the capital, $180,000. Fire suppression upgrade for the server room, $94,000 general fund, and an upgrade to the panic buttons in the building, $90,000 general fund. This budget does not contain any funding for the capital renovation project itself. That would be in the bonding bill and the capital construction bill. If that project does go forward, these last three projects would be taken out because they would be funded as part of that project, and so we wouldn't be putting out general fund. There's an increase from 6 months to 24 months, an additional 1.50 FTE for two editor positions and reclassification of two other positions in the Legislative Council. That totals $366,655 general fund. And there's establishment of a new principal analyst position in the Legislative Fiscal Office that will focus on bonding and capital construction issues. That's $260,000 general fund and $100,000 other funds. one position and one FTE. And with that, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions about anything in particular, I'd be happy to answer those.
Do you have any questions, colleagues?
Just a couple of quick ones for you, Darren. I do not recall that $34.5 million of bonding being in the legislative branch's budget when we approved it 2 years ago.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you're correct. That was approved as part of the bonding bill, and those bond proceeds were added in as limitation in the end of session bill.
Part of our clear and transparent process. The other thing is that I would bring forward is it appears we're carrying over $6 million.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
I would point out to the co-chairs and others that if we really wanted a policy department, there's more than enough money there to fund a very good one in savings.
Any other questions or comments? All righty, Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to Senate Bill 5518.
Madam Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendations to Senate Bill 5518. Colleagues, any comments? Any questions? Is there any opposition to this motion? Seeing none, so approved. Darren.
Mr. Chair, the key performance measures for the branch. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending keeping all of the key performance measures that were there with all of the same targets.
Perfect. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures.
Perfect. Is there any comments, colleagues? Any questions? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Darren.
Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 amendment is attached. You will notice it's probably slightly different than some of the others. It's a complete gut and stuff. The reason is a couple things, because it is a little more transparent this way to see exactly what was in there. The other thing was there was a little bit of a drafting issue when the bill came across from the governor, and so we went to correct it, had to add some new sections, so we just put it all out there so everyone could see exactly what was in the bill.
Perfect. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 5518.
So Madam Co-Chair moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 5518. Any comments, colleagues? Is there any questions? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5518 as amended to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
All right. Madam Co-Chair moves Senate Bill 5518 as amended to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any questions or any comments, colleagues? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Representative Nathanson, would you carry this in full and on the floor?
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair, will you carry this on the Senate floor?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. All right. Darren, is there anything else we need to think about on this before I close this work session?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair.
Okay, colleagues, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 5518, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 5021, Office of the Governor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this budget is for the actual operations of the Office of the Governor. If you remember during the public hearing, there was some discussions about several issues within the office, but the bottom line is there's an unexpected change in the administration. The Office of the Governor will need some time to kind of figure out how to structure the office and determine the appropriate level of resources. So the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending a current service level budget with instructions for the agency to return during the 2016 legislative session with a recommended budget for the remainder of the biennium. We would recommend, there's a budget note that you'll see, but we would recommend that the instructions include the revised budget addressing a number of concerns that have been raised by the legislature, and this committee has been raised several times, including a review of positions that are funded by other agencies, as well as vacant positions, and a proposal to reduce, eliminate, or align those realign those positions. So with that, there are no policy option packages in this budget. It's basically taking their legislative approved budget and recommending it to go forward as a current service level budget.
So, Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5021.
Madam Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5021. Colleagues, is there any comments on this? Senator Johnson.
Yes, please. And I apologize, sort of catching my breath racing down here. I think that you said this, Mr. Hill, but I just want to double check.
Sure.
There were a couple of positions that have to do with the Regional Solutions Team as well as one other position that had been marooned in Oregon Business Development Department's budget, and I didn't hear exactly what you said about those positions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, those positions are actually not included in this recommendation. They were limited duration positions, and those, as a rule, do not carry forward as part of the current service level. Those positions, though, have been put down on a list by the governor's office as a priority for them, and I would assume that if they are to be approved, they'll be addressed in the end of session bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification.
Is there any other comments, colleagues? Any other questions? Is there any opposition to the motion before us? Seeing none, so approved. Darren.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, with the key performance measures here, there were some issues raised by this committee about a couple of the key performance measures, but given the restructuring and the look at the organization, LFO is recommending that we leave the key performance measures here. Again, the budget note addresses that those should be addressed at the same time when they come back in 2016 to discuss the organization of their budget.
Perfect. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendations on key performance measures.
Madam Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendations on key performance measures. Colleagues, is there any discussion on this? Any questions? Is there any opposition, colleagues? Seeing none, so approved. Darren.
Mr. Chair, there is a recommended budget note, and it reads as the following. Given the timing of the change in leadership, the governor's office should review the current organizational structure and create a report showing any requested position changes. The report should also look at positions that are funded by other agencies and include the total number of positions, the total cost of those positions, and a proposal to reduce, eliminate, or realign those positions. The agency should also review its key performance measures and prepare a report on any proposed changes. Both of these reports should be presented to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means during the 2016 legislative session.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, I move the recommended budget note.
Madam Co-Chair moves the recommended budget note. Colleagues, is there any discussion on this? I would just point out very quickly, I don't think we had any opposition to any of the positions before us. We were just trying to really get our arms around who are these people, what capacity are they serving in, and who are they reporting to. So I think that's what we're trying to get at.
Mr. Chair, was that specific to the chief of staff, or were you talking about a larger class of people in the governor's office? Who are these people? What
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shipley's turning bright red out there.
All right. Is there any opposition to this? All right. Seeing none, the budget note is approved. Darren.
Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends a budget of $11,493,196 general fund, $2,730,536 lottery funds, $3,155,147 other funds, and 54 positions, 53.50 FTE, and that House Bill 5021 be amended accordingly.
Alrighty. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 5021.
Madam Co-Chair moves adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 5021. Any comments on this, colleagues? Are there any questions? Colleagues, is there any opposition to this motion? Seeing none, so approved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 5021 as amended to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 5021 as amended to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any comments? Any questions? Colleagues, is there any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Madam Co-Chair, would you carry this to full Ways and Means and to the Senate floor?
Certainly.
Representative Comp, would you carry this to the House floor?
Sure.
All right, Darren, I'm going to close this work session. Any reason why I shouldn't?
Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Not this one. Close this one.
All right, I'm closing this one, Senator Johnson.
I just wanted to watch Mr. Shipley fall
over. She likes to mess with us. All right, so we've taken care of that. Please send our best to the governor. Brian, thanks for being here. All right, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2250 relating to criminal records checks. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2250A provides clarification on state electronic fingerprint capture requirements and continues the process of consolidating background and criminal records check rulemaking authority in the Department of Administrative Services. The bill grants the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court the authority to adopt rules related to fingerprint-based background checks for the judicial branch after considering the rules adopted by the Department of Administrative Services. The bill also shifts some of the Oregon State Police Clearinghouse Program activities to the Department of Human Services. The Oregon State Police will continue to perform the background check processing, but the Department of Human Services will be responsible for conducting fitness determinations and communicating with the service providers requesting the background checks. As a result, it is anticipated that OSP will eliminate the clearinghouse program and shift the remaining work to the regulatory program. The fiscal estimate for implementation of the bill is a cost of $144,705 general fund, $509,472 total funds for the Department of Human Services, with an increase of one position to handle the new workload. Savings of just over $90,000 other funds and the elimination of one position would occur in the Oregon State Police budget as a result of the shifting of work to the Department of Human Services. The bill contains an emergency clause and is effective upon passage.
Perfect. All right. So we're in a public hearing here. Julie, do we have anyone that wants to share their thoughts?
Senator Belser, Mr. Chair, did want to testify, and I've texted her to let her know we're getting here.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, could I testify, please?
Of course you can.
This is my bill? Okay.
Of course. So is she going through that for a dramatic entrance?
Yeah, I think so.
Let's
she wants to follow protocol. We're following protocol. Wait. Oh, she wants to talk to somebody.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm still Nancy Nathanson, House District 13. This bill is the culmination of several years of work. Some of you knew about it. Some of you have not heard about it. We are finishing up what the legislature first started hearing when I first started talking about it in 2011. Dozens of occupations in the private and public sector require a background check. Dozens of occupations, and there were about 50 separate agencies that had each adopted separate processes for how to do this stuff. Home care workers, school employees, dentists, physicians, counselors and therapists, escrow agents, funeral service providers, the list goes on and on, even people volunteering in certain kinds of settings. Unfortunately, separate checks were required for an individual working in the same occupation, but for different businesses in different counties, for example, creating additional work. The expense and time add up to another burden on nonprofit organizations, local businesses, schools, and other organizations, and of course, cost and time for the applicant or volunteer. In addition to this, there are often differing criteria for passing or failing a background check that aren't consistent across clusters of occupations, such as people working with children or people working with older adults. Consistency in what's called fitness determinations across these clusters would align and normalize the criteria. In 2013, the legislature heard a set of bills to streamline the criminal background check process. Two of those that passed are already being implemented. Electronic or digital fingerprinting is being rolled out throughout the state, and the voluntary registry, which can be used for a background check when applying for other jobs, has been designed and is in the process of being implemented. The third is around the objective of portability. That's what this bill is about. Portability, meaning the background check is portable from one job to another. It means we can avoid repeating background checks to apply for the same job with a different employer, or a similar job, or a different job, but with requirements no more stringent than for the background check that was already done. And there's another member of our committee who's very familiar with having multiple background checks. The 2013 bill launched a process to standardize as much as possible the criteria used in evaluating applicants' backgrounds, such as lists of crimes committed and the look-back period, or number of years since committing the crime. DAS convened meetings with stakeholders and has identified some statutory changes that will help with standardization, and legislative counsel has been working for months to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. This bill, House Bill 2250, is another step in the process of streamlining background checks. and setting up a system that is more efficient and cost-effective. The Dash A6 amendment, as requested by Senator Gelser, makes reasonable changes to make sure that we are taking appropriate steps to streamline the process and protect vulnerable populations. It includes small changes that are meant to help clarify the intent of the bill, which is really to streamline background checks. I'm asking you to help finish what we started and pass this bill out to the full Committee on Joint Ways and Means. Thank you.
Any questions for the representative, Senator Johnson?
I was just coming back in and didn't hear Ms. McHugh's full explanation, but the authoritative agency is now DAS or OHA. I didn't understand where the activity will be centralized.
Oregon State Police still has a lot of responsibility for doing the background checks, fingerprints, working with the FBI and checking their records. A lot of work has now shifted to DHS because, frankly, DHS is doing thousands and thousands of these because many of the occupations that require background checks are through DHS, and they've had a background check unit highly active with staffing, and DHS has been central in achieving some streamlining on their own, but DAS is the agency that was directed in the legislation to convene the stakeholder group because it needed to involve all of the agencies and all of the departments. So it's DAS that convened the work and has been guiding and overseeing how to corral all these different agencies to come to agreements on how to standardize or normalize the criteria. And there is someone here from Department of Administrative Services who has convened all of those stakeholder meetings who can answer some of this in a more detailed way.
Follow.
Please.
I want to commend Representative Nathanson for her steadfastness in dealing with this issue. I was in and around the periphery of one of these work groups a million years ago, and something that is so common sense on its face invited a disastrous tsunami of opponents hollering about why this would be a bad thing, and lesser people fell away from the trail, not Representative Nathanson. My question, though, is DHS seems to be struggling with some of its core mission, and I wonder about the efficacy of putting something that will be as voluminous as this activity with the Department of Administrative Services. So I just flag that. The other thing is retention and where all of the records would be retained and how secure they would be. And then finally, and I just learned this yesterday, there are some of the systems at work in Oregon that don't speak very well in terms of, I'll give you a good example. The Portland police records, apparently, if one is stopped and one uses the name Mickey Mouse, that the system is so rigid that forever and ever you are in their system as Mickey Mouse, even though it's clear one is not Mickey Mouse.
Are you sure?
Yeah, not always. But the point of the story is that this is a good first step, and I don't want the perfect to get in the way of the good. But the point is figuring out how to be able to use these records in a way that is expeditious. We've all heard horror stories of people waiting to go to work in a daycare facility, for example, and literally waiting months to get the processing done. And so I think this will continue to be an issue area that will need constant vigilance and refinement.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, are you saying I have to work in this for how many years?
Yeah, this is like a sentencing, representative.
For pointing out, I am doomed.
You'll be toiling in this vineyard a long time.
Mr. Chair, if it's helpful, could I ask the Department of Administrative Services representative to come up and explain a little bit about respond to the issue of retention, for example, and who has the bandwidth to do this work. Some agencies will continue to do their own fitness determinations, for example.
So who would like to come up? Oh, wonderful. Welcome.
Co-chairs Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Greg Smith, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Twyla Lawson, and I'm a senior human resources consultant at the Department of Administrative Services. To Senator Johnson's question, when I think you entered the room, Representative Nathanson was speaking about the clearinghouse entities, and those are nonprofit entities across the state who work with children and elderly in like mentor programs. They are not state entities, and those checks in 3168, House Bill 3168, those checks were moved to be in the statewide rules with a fitness determination, where prior to 3168, those entities had their own crime lists. So if I was an individual nonprofit, I could make my own list of crimes that disqualify a person, and I would give it to OSP, and it was a very black and white answer, where 3168 made it a fitness determination or a weighing test. And that is not something that Oregon State Police generally does. And so what House Bill 2250 does is moves just those clearinghouse entities, that process to DHS. So we're talking about 3,000 checks a year. DHS right now is doing on average 11,000 checks a month. So it's a little tick to DHS, and both agencies have discussed it extensively, and that's the portion that is moving from OSP to DHS.
Follow, please. Your testimony introduced a degree of subjectivity into the fitness determination that hadn't caught my attention until just now. If I'm a not-for-profit and I say that any sex offense involving a child would be an automatic disqualifier. You seem to suggest that now there is a vaguer standard and that someone somewhere behind a curtain will be making a determination rather than some past activity that was an automatic disqualification. Now there is objectivity on a case-by-case determination, or did I misunderstand your testimony?
It goes to a fitness determination where they look at the facts of the crime, what crimes occurred. There may be some crimes that are absolute, but it's not based on the program or that particular entity. It's based on working with that population, so working with children or working with elderly. So it's not it's more streamlined, and it's about direct access to a population.
Do you want to follow up? But are there absolute disqualifiers? For example, if someone had been involved with elderly people and there had been some suggestion of financial fraud, in my worldview, that would be an automatic disqualifier to work with that population. And I'm trying to figure out, are there in kids with disabled people, adults and young people, seniors, are there any absolute disqualifiers in this new scheme, or can someone come in and make a case that, well, it was a long time ago and I didn't hit them really hard? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the employer still decides whether they want to hire the individual based on their record. So in Senator Gelser's amendment, there are certain crimes that are protected as disqualifying.
She should testify herself. I'm looking right over your shoulder, and there she is. But I'm just curious, with only a limited population, or are those disqualifiers across a spectrum of age and ability?
It's for that segment of the population. It's for working with those that protected group of individuals. Other individuals are in areas that have oversight boards and commissions, people who, for example, inspect facilities. There are people present watching them. So there are protections built in for those, but again, the employer doesn't have to hire someone who isn't fit for the job. and they can determine who is fit and who is not. So it's still up to the employer to say, this person looks like a great fit. This one, no. I can see their record in front of me, and I'm not going to hire that person.
Okay, so really quick, I'm going to hand the gavel over to my Madam Co-Chair. I have a meeting with the Speaker that I have to run to. We'll go from there.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt has a question.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. So essentially what you've created is the check-the-box system for DHS. Certain crimes disqualify you, period.
In the dash A6, that's correct.
Interesting. We have two different levels of the public sector and the private sector.
I think Senator Gelser maybe will help us when she comes up to talk about that. But
yeah, Madam Chair, there are not different standards for public and private sector.
No.
The standards are based on protecting individuals who either work with children, whether you're working for a nonprofit or you're volunteering at a school.
Representative, I was being somewhat facetious.
Oh,
it's not within your bill, but within the bill we just passed. For the private sector, we no longer can check the box.
So
we seem to have two classes, is my point. But could you walk us through the changes in the record and fingerprinting retention in this bill?
You have the list. Okay. So Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, I can go through and just touch some bullet points that would help explain what this does. So it moves the rule authority can you repeat your question for me so I can make sure to answer
your specific. Walk us through the changes in record and fingerprint retention that's in this bill?
Okay. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Whitsitt, this bill doesn't really address the retention of fingerprints. That's House Bill 2228 speaks to specifically the retention of fingerprints.
A previous bill.
Yes, it's a different. There is a separate bill this session, 2228, that has to do with rat back and the retention of fingerprints.
Can you explain that? Because this legislation allows the development and implementation of a system referred to as RAP-BAC system. RAP-BAC is a continuous evaluation of a subject individual who will receive near immediate notification of new criminal activity. I mean, can you explain that to us?
Can you give us a page and line number? I think it might be helpful, Senator, just so we know where you're reading from. It's a big bill, so I want to make sure that we're all answering the same questions.
This is criminal background check reform related to employment and license and volunteer authorized by Oregon State Police, ORS 181-533-534 and 267-237. It's a historical related legislation.
That's their companion bills. That one is actually in a hearing this afternoon at 4:30.
But they're moving independently of each other.
But if they both pass, they will become the law. So can you explain what we're doing here?
Yes.
I would like to reiterate that this bill is about portability. This bill stands alone. The other bill stands alone. It's possible that the legislature would pass both bills, but it's not required to pass both bills. This bill is a streamlining bill. The other this bill is intended to be about process, how to make the process of background checks more streamlined. The other bill is more aimed at policy, about how background checks are conducted and retaining fingerprints. They can be separated.
I understand that the bills are two separate bills. But if both are passed, they will become the law. What I'm trying to get at is what changes are we making if the two work together?
Madam Chair, I'm not prepared to speak to the other bill. I'm not working that bill.
Fair enough. There's also another question I have, and that is there is some significant changes regarding TSPC in this bill.
Yes, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Senator Whitsitt. That is all about trying to streamline for the population. So we have right now, we pulled the work groups together based on each population that's in the current law. So children, people with disabilities, elderly. We pulled those work groups together, and they were on absolute, you know, all across the spectrum of, you know, one university that participated in the work group had no crime specified working with children, but had no crime specified, and they used a full way test. And then we have other ones that have a very specific list. So those changes are to give us the ability in rule to refine the ability that's given in statute in rule to make a one statewide set of rules that gives the process. It's all about the process of doing the check.
And I'm going to ask my partner at the table here, could you explain how Department of Education or the education community has participated in this?
Yes, we've had Department of Education, their pupil transport, their child care division, many members, a member of their HR we've had involved in this. And Teacher Standards and Practices has been at many, most of our meetings, working alongside to help streamline this process.
I noticed there were some specific changes here to the TSPC. I was just wondering how they got in your bill. But
yes, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, we have had in history cases, many cases where someone went to work with a child, we'll say in Department of Human Services, and then went to work with that same child at the Department of Education, and then been approved in one and absolute denied in the other. And it has been because of those. And so that's been one of the reasons why those changes are in there, to streamline it.
Or maybe even more to the point, I presented testimony in 2011, I think it was, about a constituent who had worked with a child while she was in school getting a graduate degree. I'm trying to remember exactly what the positions were. She ended up having to go through three criminal background checks to work with literally the same child, providing daycare, providing counseling, and in the classroom. It required three background checks for the same person to work with the same child. This would now streamline that.
So what I'm looking at here on page 14 of the printed A engrossed bill is the Teacher Standard and Practice Commission may not issue a teaching personnel service or administrative license or register a public charter school teacher or administrator if the applicant for a licensure registration had a teaching personnel service or administrative license or registration revoked in another jurisdiction for a reason that is substantially equivalent to this. And it goes on. So it would appear that we're actually putting something out. I mean, I don't disagree with this, but it would seem that we're putting something into this that isn't streamlining. It's something that apparently the TSP has been doing that isn't appropriate. So I was wondering, is this another bill stuffed into it, or how did that come to pass?
I was not present at the meeting.
Yeah, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, the language there changes it so that it moves the determination to essentially what's called a fitness determination, a full way test. One of the challenges with the way that it's written right now that I've heard from stakeholder members, including TSPC, is they spend a significant amount of legal time defending that a certain crime in Oregon is the same crime in another state. So by doing some of these changes, you look at what the crime was, when it happened, what were the facts, and it's defendable instead of spending a significant amount of time on defending it's that crime. Does that make sense? That's part of the challenge we're dealing with.
The offensive act was substantially the same, whatever they called it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just clarify, based on the line of questioning that Senator Whitsitt had earlier, there's nothing in this legislation that conflicts with the ban the box legislation we just passed. It just says that if an applicant is being seriously considered and has a background check run, and then they have had and have something in their background that meets the automatic disqualification or could subject them to a fitness determination, then that's there. It's exactly the same as our previous as our legislation that we just passed.
Yes.
Basically saying that any employer has the right to turn down an applicant after they've gotten to the stage where there's a background check or something like that.
Yes, absolutely correct.
Okay, so this is completely consistent with that. It's holding everybody to the same standard.
Yes.
Didn't you just say, excuse me, but didn't you just say that, maybe perhaps I misunderstood, there were some offenses that categorically prevented the hiring of this individual?
And there are some crimes that are currently in statute that would prevent someone. 2250 does address some of those.
And the Dash A6. Very clear. There are some specific crimes that are disqualifiers.
Okay. We good with this panel now? Any other questions? Thank you both very much. Senator Gelser, thank you for your patience. We'd love to hear you talk about the Dash A6s. We've got about 6 minutes left, I'm afraid, folks.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, and members of the committee for your record. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, Albany and Corvallis. First, I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for her work on this issue. It's not just that it costs money and it is inconvenient when you have to go through multiple background checks. It actually gets in the way of providing services to individuals. In the human services system, a person might have a number of service hours that are assigned to them, and backlogs in the criminal background check system and the need to repeat them can mean the person never gets their service because they're waiting for the person to have the background check done. So if you recall, kind of going into that last line of questioning around the ban the box bill, it said that you cannot ask a question on the application unless there is a crime in rule or statute that would preclude you from ever hiring that person. And these are some of those issues that we're talking about. Anything that DAS puts in that rule, if you are hiring a person for that type of a job and the law or the rule says they can't do that job, then you can ask that question on the application. This is really what led to the Dash 6 Amendment. You may recall in 2009, we did a lot of work around abuse of adults and children with intellectual and developmental disabilities. At that time, there really were no exclusions for hiring based on any past criminal history. And one of the things that we know is that as victims, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities don't make really great witnesses in court. So oftentimes these cases aren't prosecuted. And so we want to make sure we have the safest possible workforce at the very beginning when people come in. I came and talked with Representative Nathanson because my concern about 2250 was it removed that section of the law that we put in House Bill 2442 in 2009 that set out a very narrow list of specific convictions that would prohibit you from being a direct service provider for a person with an intellectual or developmental disability, a person with mental illness, or a senior. The Dash 6 Amendments simply put that back into the statute, and it says that you cannot hire. It says public funds may not be used to support, this is existing law, in whole or in part, the employment in any capacity, having contact with a recipient of support services or a resident of a residential facility or an adult foster home of an individual who has been convicted of a crime specified by rule or this list. The list would remain the same as it is in current law, but we removed three crimes from that list when we did this. We've watched very carefully, as we promised we would in 2009, to see if we had put any crimes in statute that picked up people that we didn't intend to, and they tended to fall in three categories. They were two theft charges and criminally negligent homicide. So those come out of the list. Everything else that's in the list would stay there.
Senator Johnson.
I, if I understood you correctly, I'm almost speechless. So if I'd been convicted of criminally negligent homicide, that's not an automatic disqualifier?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, under current law, that is an automatic disqualifier. Under this Dash 6 amendment, we reinstated everything except for where we had specific cases come forward where we looked at the individual and that criminal history, and a weight test perhaps made more sense. It would mean that this would probably be very high on a list that would disqualify a person from a crime, but you would be able to look at what were the circumstances in that case. The more significant, there are a series of about 20 crimes that then remain in the list.
The longer I sit here, the less enthusiastic I am about a bill whose concept I'm very enthusiastic about. So we're trying to ease workload, trying to get these processes through more quickly. Now we've interjected this degree of subjectivity where we're deciding whether or not your conviction on criminally negligent homicide is a disqualifier, or theft if you're dealing with vulnerable populations. Why on earth would you take those out?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, the Dash 6 Amendment preserves most of these things. The level of theft that was in there was a relatively lower level of theft that we found when we looked at the individuals that were actually excluded or had previously been providing services to individuals. They were good care providers, and there was no ability at all to be able to look at them. This would provide that ability to look at that individual.
They're good care providers, but for being a thief.
Well, could I don't mean to interrupt, but can I ask a couple of clarifying questions? And
yes.
I recognize you're not an attorney, so we may need to get some extra help. But let me give you a couple of examples to see if I'm understanding. And I don't know statute well enough, but criminally negligent homicide, for example, if someone were driving under the influence and killed somebody while driving under the influence, that would qualify as criminally negligent homicide, I believe. Mm-hmm. And if that person had had that conviction in the past, 20 years ago, and had been sober ever since and was an active member of a recovery group or whatever it was and was able to demonstrate sobriety, is that the kind of thing that we're talking about when we talk about criminally negligent homicide?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, I want to make a clarification. The bill and the removal from the absolute exclusion list doesn't mean that we're going to run out and hire a rash of people that have convictions for criminally negligent homicide. I'm not an attorney, so I cannot tell you what that is. One of the cases that came forward was an individual who now was in her 40s or 50s, and she in her late 20s had a criminally negligent homicide conviction. She then had worked for a care provider for years and years and years and years and was an exemplary care provider. So it's not that she had this conviction while she was working. It was long in her past, and then she demonstrated her care. As this came into effect, the way that this works, if you've already gone on to the home care registry, for instance, as a care provider, you are, and you had one of these in the past, you could stay with your same client. We grandfathered people in, but if that client dies or you move on to somebody else, then you're totally excluded. And that meant with these three specific crimes, there were people who had been long-term, high-quality care providers with no abuse, no problems with their individuals, who all of a sudden couldn't do the job they'd done for a couple of decades. And that's why, in looking at reinstating most of the list, using the opportunity to make the list more appropriate.
Senator Gelser, I think that we still have some remaining questions, but it would be very helpful to the committee if you or other qualified people could provide the committee with a response to this issue, giving us more specificity about the kinds of theft that are involved, and if possible, some, not to put anybody, to disclose somebody's identity inappropriately, but de-identified cases that might illustrate to the committee why it was appropriate to remove these as absolute disqualifiers. I mean, I think the example you just gave is in line with the question I asked you about the criminally negligent homicide piece, but I think it would be helpful to the committee if you could give us a little bit more information on that.
And if I may, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward or Senator Johnson, the intent of this amendment was not to remove those. The intent of the amendment was to preserve that much longer list of automatic exclusions for care providers. I am not hung up on taking those out of the list in order to move this forward. I don't want those three things to hang up the rest of the bill. I've really been appreciative to Representative Nathanson for being responsive to the concerns that I raised about this population and the need to do more work before we remove these from statute. So I'm happy to even just draft to have ready for you an amendment that leaves those in place so you can do what you choose to do later. But I don't want those three things to hang up your discussion about the rest of the bill.
Okay, then I would say it's probably not a bad idea to have the amendment drafted, but personally, I know how protective you are of the IDD community, and I would be astonished to learn that you were taking a reckless action by excluding these from automatic disqualification. So I look forward to your response to getting us a little bit more information on this, and feel free to have the amendment drafted. Ms. McHugh, you could work with Senator Gelser. That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yeah.
Senator Gelser, you were saying that we decided the level of the offense. Well, if this were included in the bill, who would decide that on an individual basis?
So Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, Senator Whitsitt, if the Dash 6 amendment was adopted for all of the crimes that are in this amendment, there's a long list, and I can get you a list of what they are if you would like. Those would just be, nobody would do a weight test. If they had that criminal conviction, they would be ineligible to be hired.
That's not what I asked.
I'm sorry.
The three that you've called out, who would perform the weight test? Who would be responsible for making that decision?
So, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, that would go back to DAS, where DAS is looking at these broader rules in general, where they would have
each individual employee would be decided by DAS.
The criminal background check would go through DAS, and they would have rules around that weight test. Thank you.
I think we've got a lifeline. Could you kind of have to introduce yourself,
Co-Chair? Senator Hayward, members of the committee, Jeff Aiken, National Background Check Program Manager, connected to the Department of Human Services. One of the things that I think may have been misunderstood in the testimony is the fitness determinations, the background checks that are happening now aren't going to happen anywhere else. They're going to happen in the same places that they happen now, whether it be Department of Education, Department of Human Services, et cetera. House Bill 2250 through prior House Bill 3168 just moves the rulemaking to be centralized at Department of Administrative Services. So for the individuals providing care to folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities, those background checks currently occur through the Department of Human Services and will continue to be done through the people at the Department of Human Services, the background check unit. So today, under ORS 443004, which was through House Bill 2442, if they don't have one of those crimes on the automatic disqualification list, there's a weighing test, a fitness determination done. But if one of those crimes is on there, they're automatically disqualified from the position. That wouldn't change, just the criteria. The Dash A6 just changes the list.
So let me, if I may, just 1 second, Senator, let me just make sure I really understand what you're saying here.
I don't understand this at all.
You're saying, and I think Representative Nathanson said this, that the core purpose of this bill is to say, if you're a caregiver in this part of state government or with this nonprofit that contracts with state government to deliver services in any context where we would do a background check, then the qualifications and the rules around that should be identical to the ones in another part of state government or with another nonprofit if you're doing exactly the same job.
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, yes. The intent, just to put it very simply, a child is a child, an older adult is an older adult, person with developmental disabilities is a person with developmental disabilities, regardless of the program, the agency, or anything that they're connected.
And so the intention is to standardize the disqualifications, which are in statute, and standardize the weighting, and have DAS do that in consultation with the various agencies that hire or contract out for these people who do these jobs.
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, yes, for DAS to do the rulemaking for that, yet the agencies to continue
to actually do the screening.
Correct.
Themselves.
Yes.
But they would do it under a consistent set of rules, and if somebody had a background check on file for a given position for Agency A, then that background check could be used for Agency B because it would be conducted under identical rules.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Johnson, I just
want
to make sure
I understood. But the amendment cuts out the DD population and treats them differently. Because you just said a child's a child, but now we're having a different set of standards for the developmentally and intellectually disabled population, it sounds like. And if your point was that a developmentally disabled person may not make a great witness, I would submit to you that an elderly lady for whom English is not a first language might make a bad witness. A three-year-old might make a bad witness. I just don't know why the call to treat one population differently than all the rest if the idea here is to standardize and make the background checks easier.
So, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson, this allows us to continue the conversation. Right now, this actually does pick up the Elder Abuse Task Force that Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam worked on, identified a couple of exclusionary crimes for seniors. Those are also preserved in the Dash 6 amendment. Most, and Representative Nathanson, correct me if I'm wrong, most of the exclusionary crimes around hiring take place in rule. There really are only two areas where those exclusions are in statute. It's seniors and people with disabilities and teaching. And the rulemaking at DAS creates, it just makes it simpler. For the reason that I think that it's important to preserve 2250 is when you get to that question of ultimately it's up to the employer to decide who they hire, that process works differently within our IDDD system and our home care system. So DHS will do the background check and tell you as the client that they've passed the background check. You don't know what those crimes are. So for instance, my son is about to have a new care provider. We won't have any access to what that criminal background check is. That care provider will be in the home with my son doing personal care at the same time my teenage daughters are home and no other adults are there. Because this is currently the statute, I know, even though I don't get to see the criminal background check, that the person has never been convicted of a sex crime, doesn't have a history of trafficking in persons, kind of this limited list. That's different than most employers where the employer themselves would see the actual criminal background check and be able to make that decision of whether or not to have that person in their work site. And that's why it's different for seniors and people with disabilities for now.
So then my question, Senator, is if I understood you correctly, you said that most of the disqualifying things are in rule for most occupations. Is that true for teachers as well? I mean, if you look at the section in 2250 now that talks about TSPC, is that reference there? Maybe Representative Nathanson can answer this even better, but is the reference in TSPC on page 14, starting line 28, it says to a reason described in ORS 342.175, is that those are automatic disqualifiers?
Those are automatic disqualifiers that are currently in statute, and this bill is removing them from statute.
That doesn't appear to be the case in this. It seems to say that they've...
So all the deleted language, and then that's what the bold language is. It's pointing back to DAS that's writing the rules around the fitness determination. And TSPC has been very involved in putting this together.
Okay. I think we're all a little bit confused at this point. We all agree with the intention.
And Representative Nathanson? So then the point, again, is because you have people working with children who may be a teacher but also may be a daycare provider part-time or volunteer as a coach at a different child's school. You may have someone who currently needs to have a criminal background check done through Department of Education, but maybe also through DHS, or maybe also through the Youth Soccer League or something like that, because the rulemaking authority now would reside with DAS. DAS has been meeting with stakeholders, bringing all these multiple agencies or departments together to talk about how to write the rules so that the lists of crimes and look back years and so forth will be the same to get it all normalized across all the different departments that apply to working with
children. It's not only teachers. It's daycare providers or counselors, therapists, you know.
Chair Steiner Hayward, if I may ask a question, please. Thank you. But just to clarify, my understanding is that with all the different boards and commissions and all the different professions, although I understand what you're doing and I appreciate you're trying to make it so that people don't have to do multiple background checks and they can do it in one place, one-stop shopping, and then you as the consumer, the buyer, the employer, whatever you want to call it, can say, oh, here's the background check and it's done. This, as I understand it, has nothing to do with what the criteria is for accepting a position. So if you go and apply for a job to be a radiology technician or you want to work as a physical therapist or anything like that and you need to have a background check, all those entities are going to have a different set of criteria as to what they accept and don't accept, correct?
Currently.
Because the Teacher Standards Practices and Commission has one set of standards for allowing someone to become a teacher. To become a radiology technician, you have a different set of standards. We don't hold for all professions everybody by the same
that's
standards.
Correct. Right. That's correct.
So that's why there won't be one section of the law that's going to say the automatic disqualifiers.
For every profession.
Right. So it's going to vary by each profession. And I can't imagine that Senator Gelser wants to subject from her long life of devoted to look, we're fighting for folks who have disabilities, to subject them to folks who have had convictions in the past. You're trying to carve out some rare circumstances under which somebody is, if you could just kind of clarify with
sure.
those.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Taylor, where the list came from that's currently in statute that the Dash 6 ensures stays in statute was right. developed over the course of a year with a lot of traveling around the state, talking to a lot of people, looking very specifically at a very narrow risk that would put a person, a vulnerable person, at specific risk. Mm-hmm. We started with, it's a much smaller list than the TSPC mm-hmm. list, a vastly smaller list. The TSPC list has sorely needed updating mm-hmm. for yes. a very, very long time. There are all kinds of things on that list that should not be there. Mm-hmm. And this helps with that.
Senator Johnson.
I thought the plan, I'm just getting more and more confused the longer we sit here. I thought the plan was to try to get a standardized set of criteria. Now it looks like we're going to be analyzing cases on a one-off, and I understand the criminally negligent homicide that happened 20 years ago. I get that, but I'm trying to understand why theft. I mean, it seems to me that if there is a standard list of disqualifiers, abuse, those sorts of things, they ought to go across all of the all of the background check requests. It seems to me that we're setting up a situation where it's okay if you had theft if you were taking care of an old lady, but not so much with a developmentally disabled child. I'm totally lost at this point.
So could I try one more time?
Yeah, and we're going to have to wrap up here because we're 15 minutes past our time. I mean, I think it was important to keep going, but we're going to have another conversation about this. So one more comment, Senator.
So co-chair, you.
Whatever.
and Senator Johnson, I appreciated
y'all.
The way you
y'all.
The way you asked that question was really helpful. The intent of the bill is to create a uniform, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nancy, or Representative Nathanson. Gosh, yeah, we're 15 minutes over. To create a uniform set of guidance and rules around how we do that individual determination when a criminal background check comes through. And you do this weight test where you look at that person's history and the job that they're applying for and how those two things come together. Because, you know, there may be a person for whom theft, if they're going to work for in one agency, that theft may be very, very relevant. Someplace else, it may not. But these create those rules to allow the safety for a subjective determination on a person-by-person basis so we can have the safest workforce across all these populations.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
DAS has worked for months, and also with Mr. Aiken present mm-hmm. and participating, being the expert in background checks, it has been working for months with all of the agencies who have been very protective of the populations for which they do these background checks to basically get everyone to the point where they're agreeing. how to do this and make it work for those people who they're trying to protect. So even the teacher's standards and practices, TSBC, Department of Education, DHS, all these different partners have been participating for all these months and have come up with this plan. And they are the ones who are charged with protecting these different populations.
Okay. I'm going to call it quits for today. We clearly have to get some more information so that we can all understand this a little bit more. I'll circle with Senator Gelser and Representative Nathanson and maybe Mr. Aiken with you as well to get a little bit more clarity, and we'll plan on coming back soon to be continued at a future date. So for now, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2250, and if there's no more business before the committee, we're adjourned. We're adjourned.